You're listening to Solar Insiders, the fortnightly podcast that shines the light on the world's biggest energy source. Solar Insiders is presented by Giles Parkinson, the editor of Renew Economy, and Sophie Voroth, the editor of One Step Off the Grid. Solar Insiders is brought to you by Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes. And Nextracker, delivering the most advanced solar tracking technology and the highest performing solar assets in the country.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Solar Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated website, the EV Focus, The Driven. And joining me, as usual, is Renew Economy's deputy editor and the editor of One Step Off the Grid, Sophie Voroth. Sophie, I hope you are well.
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah, well, that's good. Look, we've got a really interesting interview coming up, not directly about solar, kind of more about sort of virtual power plants, which is important for the solar industry because it's going to be very much part of, the growth in virtual power plants. But I thought I just might sort of start off with some of the other big solar news around the place. And I'm particularly interested in the fact that the story that we're running this week about Australia falling out of the global top 10 in solar. I thought we were supposed to be the leaders. I thought, we're right up there. What's going on?
Well, it seems like we're losing it on a couple of metrics. We have the Netherlands hot on our heels for that one that we love to talk about, which is the highest, the most amount of solar per capita. So we're still leading that, but we could lose it this year, according to Renata Egan from APVI, who has sent us their latest global solar snapshot, which is APVI takes part in every year. Yes, we've for the first time in 20 years dropped out of the top 10. So that's for annual installed capacity. So the benchmark this year was 4.2 gigawatts, and obviously we only got to, 3.8.
Look, yeah, something like that. Look, we can't really glance. Look, yeah, so the Netherlands got the 10th spot in 4.2 for the year. The top one, I mean, just to put things in perspective, the top one was China, which was 235 gigawatts.
Yes. Just a little bit ahead of the rest of the world.
Only about 100 times bigger than, or maybe say 50 times bigger than the Australian market. But look, it wasn't because of households or businesses, because they'd done their thing, because they did about 3 gigawatts last year. I guess that's down to the fact that the utility scale solar has declined rapidly, slowed down quite significantly. So that's the consequences of it. And look, just in terms of cumulative capacity, just looking at this graph here, Australia is still at number 8. On about 35 gigawatts, just less than 35 gigawatts. That's household solar and utility scale solar, but being chased down by Italy and Korea. Once again, we're about 1/20th of the size of China, which is 662 gigawatts, followed by the United States, 170 gigawatts, and India, 95 gigawatts. Japan, much smaller country than ours, 91 gigawatts.
I know, that's really surprised. Japan surprised me, and it looks like, Korea, is going great guns.
They installed
nearly as much as us this year. I mean, 3.3 gigawatts.
Well, they've almost got as much total capacity as us, and yet they're probably about the size of Victoria. Look, I can't really tell off the top of my head like that, but I mean, on the map it doesn't look that much bigger than Victoria, but
what are you saying about Victoria?
lovely weather, just beautiful weather. Just
don't
always
like
always
your tone.
Well, look, talking about the weather, actually, Victoria, we just got the wholesale. No. Let's stick with Renata first, because she says that there's a bit of a consequence here. There's another problem looming for Australia. We've been a key part of the research and development for solar PV, which we know, but apparently we're at risk of sort of losing our spot in one of the main global research groups. What's going on there?
We are. Well, this is the global research group that was kicked off by the International Energy Agency in 1993. It's called the PV Power Systems Program, and it's the group that puts out this report every year. But they have, an overarching mission just to sort of advance solar in every way that they can. And they do that by collaborating with there's 31 countries that participate, And, you know, they pool all of this expertise. They've got all these sort of submissions, which are really important and incredible. And, yeah, APVI has been part of it for, or the APVI has been part of it for, you know, I think all of that time, and probably one of the leaders considering Australia's research and development prowess. But we have no funding anymore, apparently. I think it was federal. And as Renata said, this seems like an extraordinary state of affairs, considering we're about to spend $1 billion on, you know, setting up a solar supply chain. I'm hoping there might be some spare change to keep us in this amazing group.
Well, that just sounds extraordinary and a bit of a sort of a conflict of signals, as so often happens in politics and government, unfortunately. But there you go.
Yeah, okay. Renata says that they've been working with the government to try and sort of fix it. So hopefully they can sort something out because, yeah, it would be a bit of an embarrassment if we weren't included in this global report because basically I think all of the countries contribute their own data, and obviously this costs some money and there needs to be support, but it's incredibly important.
Well, maybe they can put it, like, maybe they can sort of ledger it as a visit to Gina Reinhart's birthday party or something like that. That's one way to get funding in the tax space to pay for it.
Perhaps indeed.
Oh, you just got to think. You got to think laterally about these things. Yeah.
You do. Gosh, perhaps we need to ask Mr. Dutton then.
Yes, that's right. He'll be very much in favour. Look, speaking of rooftop solar, it's done a wonderful job helping power prices fall across the national electricity market in the first quarter, including in sunny Victoria. Unfortunately, there's a big storm that went through Victoria, as we remember, in early February, which and it's just extraordinary the damage that did to the power, well, not just to power lines, the fact that there were sort of blackouts and things like that, and the biggest coal generator went offline. But the latest report from the Australian Energy Regulator just sort of highlights just how impactful this was on consumers, particularly in Victoria, which and South Australia, because of the network issues there. Victoria's wholesale power prices would have come down quite significantly, but because of the cost of just 2.5 hours of peak power prices near the market cap, pushed the average price of the wholesale price of electricity, which is just one part of people's consumer bills, up by around about $23 a megawatt hour. And that sort of splattered over the whole quarter. I mean, it's quite extraordinary numbers, really.
It is. Does it matter that most of those people had no power at that time?
And they weren't paying for it. That's an interesting point, actually. Yes. Good point. Anyway, but look, I haven't actually sort of done the numbers yet, and sort of multiply the number of gigawatt hours sort of consumed over the quarter and that $23 a megawatt hour, but quite significant. And it was kind of interesting to note that the two states that experienced price hikes in average over the quarter were two of the states that's mostly dependent on coal. You know, Victoria, because of that incident and the outage from the Loy Yang A generator, which is still not fully explained, and then all the series of heat waves up in Queensland, which is the country's most coal-dependent state. And it kind of underlines the fact that these coal states dependent on coal-fired generation are actually quite vulnerable to these extreme weather events. So food for thought, because people like to sort of say, well, the weather's going to affect the wind and solar, but it affects more than just wind and solar, and it's particularly impactful on fossil fuel generation.
Yeah.
Look, before we get into this interview, is there any other news that we need to record? There's a couple of rebates, battery rebates. There's been some data on batteries. We've got more batteries. We need more batteries. Queensland's coming into elections, and they're throwing more. Queensland's throwing more rebates
money
at them,
yep,
for about 1,000 more. Clean Energy Council wants $6,000, is it $6,500 rebates for everyone everywhere for batteries? I think. And then one of the most popular stories this week is a New Zealand company coming in with some reinvented lead acid battery,
yes,
which kind of sounds like sort of Duran coming back, looking sort of slightly older and trying to make a hit, but
still wearing leather pants.
But still wearing leather pants. So, Look, that's probably quite shameful, actually, when you describe this new technology or this sort of advanced technology. But it's kind of interesting, the sort of the interest that it has out there amongst the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think any new battery products always get a lot of interest. And, you know, as you and I were talking about before, there is lead acid still out there. You know, we do see them at the expos and stuff. You know, every year I see it and think, still having a go. And this does claim to have some significant sort of changes to the technology that make it work. So yeah, it'd be very interesting to see. And obviously components are cheaper and more sort of readily available than lithium ion at the moment.
Okay. Look, I think it's probably time to have a listen to our interview that we did, or that I did actually. This is just sort of something sponsored, sort of prompted, sorry, by a quite a big fundraising, $86 million for the Irish-based Grid Beyond, which is called a sort of smart solution software, particularly all those sort of, you know, tricky little things that you need to have virtual power plants. And they're doing business in Australia. They're focusing on virtual power plants, particularly at the industrial and commercial level. And it's just really interesting to sort of hear his words about, you know, sort of how the consumers are kind of driving this transition, which is, I guess, in a way, what we've seen in Australia. But let's have a listen to Michael Phelan. He's the CEO and co-founder of Grid Beyond. So, Michael Phelan, thanks for joining the podcast.
Good to be here.
Yeah, look, it's a big day for Grid Beyond. It's a 52 million euro fundraising. That is by far the biggest that you've done to date, I understand.
It is, yeah. It's a strong endorsement of the platform we're developing, and I suppose the markets that we've selected that have a need for our path to zero carbon type solutions. And we look forward to growing in those countries over the next number of years, including Australia.
Yeah. So how did Grid Beyond actually sort of start out? What was the idea? What was the plan?
Well, the concept and plan was always the same. It was to add things like flexibility that exists in industrial and commercial sites and batteries and various storage systems to the grid so that people could put more solar and more wind and various things like that onto the grid that are intermittent and need a counterbalance, if you like, in terms of the demand side.
So is it more focused on the consumer market, you know, the sort of the households and business, or is it sort of also focused on large-scale installations?
It's across all. So we do a fair bit of industrial and commercial implementations or putting in systems to gather the kind of flexibility that you would have in a mine, or you might have in a metals plant or a cement plant or a food plant. Or indeed an office or a hospital or a university, but also in SME area and also in residential. In all instances, what we're doing is we're balancing out the complementarity of putting things like storage or maybe flexibility that might exist in a building with solar or with wind to maximize the consumption really of the solar and the wind and to make sure that it's not wasted, as might be the case when you've excess solar and you have no ability to capture it, like is happening in South Australia.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, so you guys are based in Ireland, I understand. So, give us an update of what's happening in Ireland in the transition to sort of green energy.
So Ireland's fairly similar to Australia. We're probably more wind based with a certain amount of solar, and we've kind of the same problems. So, opportunities, I suppose, from our point of view. So what's happening is we're putting lots and lots of wind onto the grid and a fair bit of solar, and obviously they're intermittent. So when they're there, we need to store them, so that when they're not there, we can fill the gaps using things like batteries, using the storage that might exist already in, say, a water system or a cold storage system or various systems, so that we can use the excess wind we might have at certain times and give it back to the grid or reduce the consumption at other times.
Sure. And so Grid Beyond doesn't actually make wind turbines or solar panels or batteries even. It's really just the sort of the software and the smart stuff that actually sort of links them all together and sends signals to sort of do certain things at certain times. And presumably that's also linked in with the consumption, particularly in sort of commercial and household instances. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. We use artificial intelligence really to allow us to optimize really the consumption based on the forecasts we have for things like renewables. So we will forecast things like what solar going to do, what's the wind going to do, what's the grid generally going to do, what's the load at a particular point in time, either on a local site or even in a house or something, and what's the need. In other words, if the renewable is not going to meet the requirement, you know, is there thermal plants on, or are there enough thermal plants to meet the requirement? Are there batteries on? Are there enough of those to meet the requirement? And then how can we optimize the assets we have, which are most likely going to be things like batteries and flexible loads and the likes? How can they be optimized to maximize the use of renewables really on the grid?
And when you sort of talk about artificial intelligence, what do you mean by that and why is it necessary?
So the grid, obviously, the supply and demand have to balance all the time. So there's a lot of decisions to be made very, very quickly on the grid. So in Australia, for example, you run on a 5-minute market. So every 5 minutes, the AMO people have to make a decision as to whether supply and demand is matching. And they need a market, and they have a market mechanism to cause that to happen. So our artificial intelligence systems allow us forecast, say, renewable energy load, price and various things, and then decide based on all the things we're seeing what the grid needs to continue to balance over the next period of time. So we would decide whether we should be charging a battery depending on the state of the grid, discharging a battery, charging a load, in other words, driving a load maybe towards a lower temperature or something like that so it can be turned off later on. So the artificial intelligence allows us to make that decision every 5 minutes.
Right. You said in your release that the funding for this from this raising is going to be used primarily to sort of advance your leadership in virtual power plant technology across the globe, including in Australia. Can you sort of describe to us what your definition of a virtual power plant is?
So a virtual power plant is something that links renewables on the generation side, or indeed on the consumer side, with flexibility. So there are things like batteries, flexible loads, electric vehicles, thermal cooling, thermal heating, various systems that are flexible, that can move around a little bit depending on the amount of renewable that's on the grid. And the system is constantly trying to balance supply and demand.
Right. Because in Australia, we understand virtual power plants to be, I mean, it's sort of been offerings by various sort of, you know, providers. They sort of get, you know, 1,000 customers or 10,000 customers, and they kind of join them all together. And then they're able to package this up using sort of, you know, the technologies that you've mentioned as a resource that can then be used by the grid. It can either sort of send energy, or it can send sort of frequency, respond to the frequency control market. Is that the sort of thing that you're doing?
That's part of it, but like when eventually it all kind of comes together, you can be managing both the generation side and the demand side. So obviously in Australia, you guys have a lot of solar in the distribution network, and that typically is on customer sites. So that can be used as a generation asset, obviously, that has an effect on the balance of the grid. But on the other side, you've also got a lot of distributed solar, distributed wind, distributed batteries, so they are also really useful resources for balancing the grid. So you can be both on the supply side and the demand side, and we operate on both. So we are often working front of the meter, as we call it, which is on the generation side as well as on the demand side, to balance things out and optimize the flexible assets that are on the grid.
Okay, and what have your activities so far been in Australia?
So we have been working quite a bit with really all industrial and commercial sectors. So we've a good few customers in the different industrial and commercial sectors. And I suppose to date, we've been putting people into FCAS market, WDRM, PDRS, the various systems that are there. Our next phase is really to help the customers on the path to zero carbon. So a lot of the mines and a lot of the industrial customers and commercial customers on the path to zero carbon. We do a fair bit of work on that in UK and Ireland. We're one of the leaders in it. And we plan to bring, as part of this funding, bring that to Australia and various other Asian markets.
So that's basically, it's like you've got a big industrial customer then. I mean, they might have significant loads, you know, 100 megawatts, 200 megawatts, 300 megawatts, whatever. They're writing contracts for renewable energy supply, be it wind or solar. They might be doing some sort of hedging with sort of batteries and things like that. So presumably your technology in that particular circumstance is really just allowing them to sort of maximize their use of 100% of renewables, if that's what they're aiming for.
It is that, yes. So what we're trying to do is to tie together the, say if you take a mine or you take a metals plant or something like that, they will have flexible load. So their loads tend to be flexible depending on what they're trying to produce and what quantity they're trying to produce. So we will look at the production plan or the plan for the plant. We would also look at, say, if it's a solar plant, we might look at the forecast for solar. We might look at battery capacity that they would have. They might have electrified some vehicles and things. So we would look at the charging plan for those. And then we would optimize. So we'd forecast all of that first and see what we think is going to happen and what prices are looking at, like if they're importing from the AMO grid. And then we would optimize the whole thing and come up with, as you say, the optimum solution to, I suppose, minimize the cost and minimize the carbon usage, if you like, in the system.
Right. Okay. So for like a mine operator, would you be suggesting that they sort of wind down? If it's a flexible load, are you sort of given a certain parameters where you can sort of literally, you know, there might be a processing plant or something like that, you can dial that down because, you know, given the parameters that you've been given, they don't want to be producing when they're forced to use, say, diesel gensets or something like that.
Yeah, we could look at that. So we normally would look at their production plan. So what do they need to produce? What is their plan for the day? Do they have spare capacity? And if they have spare capacity, then we would probably use it against the high prices in the market. So if you're seeing a really bad day in AMO, maybe $15,000 type prices, you may or may not want to be consuming at that time, depending on what you're extracting from the mine. And if you have flexibility in the production schedule or in the schedule for the plant, it might make sense to basically reduce at that time.
Mm. Whereabouts in the world do you sort of see these sort of things as being the most advanced? I mean, what's an example of, you know, where these things are just like really at the cutting edge now?
So anybody who has lots of renewables, so there's lots of renewables in the UK and Ireland, so they're quite advanced markets. But so is California, so is ERCOT or Texas, and so is Australia. They're probably the most advanced markets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And where are we heading with this? I mean, just sort of describe the way that you imagine the grid. I don't know whether it's going to be in a year or 5 years or 10 years time, and the way that that operates, because, you know, pretty much all these countries are pretty set on kicking fossil fuels out of their grid. Most of them have sort of very strong targets. In the Northern Hemisphere, some will have some baseload because they've got nuclear. In Australia, choosing to go with wind and solar only, backed up by some dispatchable generation, mostly storage. EVs are coming into the market now. Not everywhere are they sort of, you know, vehicle to grid and got two-way behavior, but that's been worked on. So what do you imagine this all looks like in the future?
Well, I guess the other piece that's probably needed, but it's probably another form of storage, is long-term storage. But if you have short-term storage, long-term storage, a lot of flexibility in the short-term markets, as you describe, whether they be batteries, whether they be flexible loads, there's quite a bit of flexibility already out there through demand response in buildings, in assets, in thermal heating, various things. So I think if you add in long-term storage as well, I think you have a system that can capture excess solar, excess wind, and then give it back when there isn't such an amount of solar and wind, especially in countries like Australia and, say, California and others, where the climate, you kind of know what's going to happen at a certain, you know, to a reasonable extent, what's going to happen a lot of the time. And if you have long-term storage to get you through the storms and the various things, for the rest of the time, things are reasonably predictable. I think you can make that kind of transition. I suppose Ireland and UK are kind of similar. You know, they're probably more wind-based, but, like, you know, they're windy places and probably have some hydro already, so they have some rain that they can kind of figure out as well, get plenty of it. And then, you know, it's tying in solar, tying in storage. That combination maybe with something like anaerobic digestion or other systems that might make sense, you could probably, you know, develop a grid on those that uses only those, but is obviously dependent on flexible loads. And I suppose luckily for all of us, there's a certain amount of flexibility in transportation in EV, and it's a certain amount of flexibility in thermal storage, whether it be chilling or heating. And they are the things we would be adding more of as we kind of decarbonize, you know, getting rid of gas or oil for heating, or getting rid of them from transport as well. So that's a lot of what's happening on the demand side. So if you're doing that, then you need the assets you put in to replace them need to be capable of short and long-term storage. Mm.
And how readily will people, will the EV market lend itself to this? Because it's sort of one thing for people to start driving around in EVs. It's another thing to get the technology that allows that sort of bi-directional charging. Then it's probably another thing to actually get them into a spot where you can actually declare them to be a resource.
It depends. I think there's a bit of an education thing there. Like most people, when they have cars and things in most countries, you know, don't use them to anything like the extent of their capability. So they will need to be assured that if, for example, you're doing vehicle to grid or vehicle to building or various things, that it's still staying within the warranty and doesn't void the warranties of the car or the van or the truck or whatever it is. But beyond that, they probably won't really care. Because like the thing is, the battery on wheels, with working from home and various things now, cars and things will spend a good bit of time connected to the grid. And they're a very, very valuable resource in terms of they could capture excess solar during the day and give it back in the evening peak and save money, obviously, for the person themselves.
It's interesting when you sort of talk about virtual power plants, because basically, you know, in a way, you're kind of sort of ceding control of your operations or sort of the management of your business or the running of your home even to a third party, or in this case, you know, like artificial intelligence potentially. Not all people are prepared to do that. I mean, I guess in some of the business operators, they're prepared to do that because you can tell them we can save you a lot of money, particularly with high electricity costs. Just how much is that sort of, you know, that sort of question of sovereignty over your own things, you know, an impediment to virtual power plants?
Well, as you say, in the industrial and commercial area, they don't see it as that because they probably recognize that unless they put in backup systems, they have no control on the electricity system today. Like if somebody decides for whatever reason or a system takes down electricity, you know, it's a different world then. Mm. And they probably appreciate that and understand that. So I suppose all people are doing here fundamentally is they're making sure that that doesn't happen. They don't lose their supply of electricity with their assets being used, if you like, within their warranties. But it's not much different to a washing machine today or something. You know, they're depending on the grid not to void the warranty of that system. So if they deliver the wrong voltage, the wrong frequency in various systems, that system will burn out. Yeah. So it's no different. Like in terms of a virtual power plant, you're just using other assets. You're keeping them within their warranties and they're keeping the lights on.
Okay. And so specifically this funding, you've got 52.25 million euro to be exact, and you're talking about putting into virtual power plants. So what does that mean? Is that sort of investing in new technology? Is that rolling out new systems? What exactly are you going to be using that money for?
Yeah, so it's continuing to develop new products. So we're kind of continuing to develop this production optimization product against energy markets. We're also continuing to develop a patent net zero type system. So our idea really is, and it's kind of what you described. So we start off, a customer says, yeah, I want to go on a path to zero carbon. So we give them a plan, maybe baseline them to explain where they are today in terms of what fossil fuel is in their mix. And then we might take them through a path of corporate PPAs, say solar on the roof, batteries, EV chargers, maybe look at their cooling, heating, various systems, or hot water systems, whatever their needs are there, how should they be electrified? So you're taking them on that journey. And then you're trying to make sure that through a fuel mix and indeed an asset mix, that they can move towards zero carbon. So that in itself is a fair bit of work. So and the idea is to do 24/7 power matching. So there's lots of people out there today that said, oh, we use green energy. We've used it for years. And what they're doing is buying renewable certificates on a yearly basis and saying, on a yearly basis, I bought enough renewable certificates to match my consumption. But that doesn't really get you to the energy transition. What gets you to the energy transition makes you auditable to prove that your, at least your supply and demand is clean, is being able to do 24/7 power matching. And that's the thing we're looking at.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And given the sort of technologies and the grid supplies and the also what goes into sort of respective grids, and then you've got sort of different rules and different grids. I mean, is there an easy place to do business, or does each little jurisdiction have its own challenge?
They all have their own issues, slightly different issues. And it's kind of interesting when you kind of are across the, if you like, the globe, especially the ones doing the renewable transition, to see the different issues. But generally with the grids, there are probably industries that haven't had to innovate a lot. So it was always thermal power really, and maybe sometimes nuclear. You know, supply was the controllable thing. Generation basically was the controllable thing. So supply, the generation basically always met the demand, and you were always balancing on that side. So it's a really big change for them that the supply side is becoming, our generation side is becoming intermittent, and they need the demand side to actually allow the grid to balance and work today. So a lot of them are really on that transition, and especially in an industry that is not that used to innovation, it poses certain challenges, but they're making the best of it. They're keeping the lights on. and right. doing the best they can.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you guys are kind of, in a way, sort of providing the glue that sort of holds all these different systems together and helps them sort of, you know, work in the most optimal fashion. When you sort of look at the sort of the transition to zero emissions and all the different targets and different countries and sort of global targets and things like that, I mean, are you sort of, do you sit in the optimist camp, or are you sort of so far in the industry that you kind of can see all the warts and all and going, oh God, this is going to be hard, or do you think it can be done?
I think it can be done, but I think it's going to come from the consumer and the industrial commercial side. I think they're probably driving it more so than anybody else. And probably are in a position to do it as well, because you can, like the kind of things we're describing, that if you can show, say, an industrial site or a commercial site, what 24/7 power matched renewable looks like, and obviously consumption, clean consumption without gas and oil, if you can show what that looks like, then you can build on that. And a lot of the industrial and commercial customers are up for doing that today. So if you look at data centers, you look maybe at pharma, medical device, maybe food, there's certain groups already, and that's what they are trying to achieve. But in trying to achieve that, they obviously challenge us and challenge various people to cause that to happen. And then we all learn more about the grid and what consequences that has for the grid. But I think it's coming from that side. And I think even in places like Australia, California is the same. You know, people have gone ahead and put solar on the roofs, you know, maybe trying to figure out that they need storage, community storage, various things. What does that all mean? And I think the consumer and the industrials are driving it to a fair degree. And I think the governments are trying to help as best they can and support as best they can. But it's that kind of dynamic is causing it all to happen. And then everybody else is making sure they're trying to keep up. I don't see it as being driven by, if you like, too much by the utilities themselves and the likes. I think it's more the consumer and the industrial and commercial people.
It's interesting, actually, because I guess about the consumer, this change probably wouldn't happen as quickly as it is now. It's kind of a flipping of the role of the sort of the power industry and the consumer, isn't it? It's now the consumer that either has the power or wants the power, and because it wants the power and it's got local, it's got the things that at its disposable, it does have the power.
It does, and because there's a lot of innovation on the grid edge. Like a lot of these technologies are almost off the grid. The innovation is almost coming from the consumer side. So it's people innovating in the customer sites, in the homes, in the SMEs, putting in their assets, putting in their solar, their batteries, their EV chargers, their heating and cooling systems being electric. So everything's electric. That's kind of driving a lot of it. And then taking it up the next level to the industrials doing similar things and the commercials. So that on one side, and then I suppose investors coming in, you know, the environmentally responsible type investors coming in on the other side and building large solar farms, large wind farms, large battery systems, and that's a lot of what's driving it, and that's putting pressure then on the middle. So the middle then has to try and keep up and give the connections and the infrastructure, if needed, that's needed to cause that to happen. And then I guess you get the agencies coming in and trying to help and stimulate something they know they need, like in Australia with ARENA coming in and trying to do community batteries or kind of smaller systems and make sure that they're going to get put in place as well. So that it's an interesting ecosystem, but as you say, it seems to be being driven by the consumer, industrial, commercial people, and probably the investors.
Yeah. Well, fascinating stuff. Well, Michael Phelan, thanks very much for joining the podcast. It's been fascinating hearing your story and your perspective.
And thanks very much for having me. It's quite an interesting discussion.
So that was Michael Phelan, the CEO and co-founder of Grid Beyond. Sophie, look, we've got virtual power plants happening in Australia, but I guess there's a lot of way to go before we sort of really sort of plug into the potential of this. And it's kind of interesting to see there's a lot of talk now at both regulatory and policy and analyst and advocate level about this sort of, you know, this pushing of consumer energy resources and making sure that they're like, you know, this critical part of the grid and making sure it happens, basically, because that's an awful lot of capacity and potential which can possibly reduce the amount of other stuff we need to build.
Yeah, and I think that this has sort of been known in the industry for a while now, and I think the part that's missing still is selling it in its entirety to consumers. I think, you know, it's still sort of trying to get past that thing where people get solar and they get a battery because they want independence, and probably the last thing they want is to say, oh, well, you take control of it and do what you will, even though that may be the best thing for everybody. So I think, yeah, it's still a big piece to go of sort of education and explaining exactly what it is and how it can benefit consumers.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean sending a text message to say, can I boil my kettle now? But
no, it look, doesn't. It,
please, I really want a cup of tea.
Switching off the TV in the last dying minutes of the football.
That's right, yes. Oh, really? Oh, okay, of course. Yes, for the grid. For the grid!
Yes. No, and I, you know, I think I was it in that you know, in the story about the batteries, you know, it does seem like there is still a bit of skepticism that you know, especially some of the incumbent players will do the right thing and aren't just in it for themselves, Giles.
Yes, well, yes. Heaven forbid that that could ever be used as a description for anyone listening to this podcast or out there in the great consumer world. Sophie, it's been wonderfully entertaining. I think we should quit while we're ahead. And thank all our listeners out there. Thank Michael Phelan for Grid Beyond for joining the podcast. Thanking you. Thanking our sponsor, Pylon. And we'll be back again with another episode of Solar Insiders in a fortnight.
See you then.
Solar Insiders was brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly costs and no lock-in contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals. Solar Insiders is also brought to you by Nextracker, delivering some of the highest-performing solar assets in the country. Like a sunflower follows the sun, Nextracker's market-leading solar solutions deliver optimal return on investment for utility solar farms in Australia. Check out their flagship NX Horizon Smart Solar Tracker, their intelligent optimization software, and the industry's most advanced terrain-following solar tracking technology, NX Horizon XTR.